Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are here with
Todd Kreidler, director,
and Eugene Lee, the actor.
And we're here to talk August Wilson's How I Learned What I Learned, which is at Roundhouse Theater from June 7th through July 2nd. Thanks so much for coming in, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Now, August Wilson has been all over the place lately, especially because of Fences, the movie. And explain for our listeners that maybe have been living under a total rock what the Pittsburgh cycle was and then where this came in relation to that.
The cycle of plays, in a sentence, takes a look at decade by decade what newly freed slaves did with their freedom over a 100-year period. That's in a nutshell.
Through the whole 20th century, there was a new play for each decade.
Exactly right. What was the other question?
Oh, okay. Oh. And then where this fits in, because this isn't part of the Pittsburgh cycle. This is more of an autobiographical look at Wilson himself.
Right, and this was actually a piece that August originally performed himself and was meant to sort of be what's next, the first thing that would be next after the cycle. So we planned after Radio Golf was sort of set up in the regions and we were developing it, then we would begin to take the offers we had to do this show, which he performed and which I originally directed.
You directed the original one where it was like a one-man show with August.
It was a one-man show and we created this. So I co-conceived this with him in his basement, you know, I was going to say it was 2003, so almost 14 years ago to the day, because I recall Memorial Day being the last day off before the first audience and the panic of, you know, putting together the show. So I think of this time of year, we did it in Seattle at Seattle Repertory Theater.
What is that moment that he's just wrapped up the cycle with Radio Golf and you're sitting in his basement, you said, take me back, you know, I mean, put us there, paint a picture for our radio listeners.
Oh, sure. Well, actually, it didn't quite play out that way. When I first met him, I began working with him on his play, King Hedley II. So I worked with him on the last three plays of the cycle and became his dramaturg. But I started as his assistant in Pittsburgh, and we would hang outside the theater, and I stepped into this unlikely relationship at the age of 25, and he's smoking cigarettes, and we were falling into like a slipstream of conversation. We're late for rehearsal. People are coming to bring us in because we thought we were outside for 5 minutes, and we were outside for 3 hours. And he was telling me at the time, Todd, man, I'm working on this show called I'm Not Spalding Gray. And it was his one-man show. And so I just jumped on, and so I started to develop bits with him about this. Now, make it clear, there was no show. There was no production. No one was lined up. It was just sort of us on the street corner. And then 7-8 months later, we were studying comedy routines on Kings of Comedy DVD. And he said, man, we're going to call it Move Over Chris Rock, and I'm going to do my own brand of stand-up comedy, you know. And then another 6 months, he's like, no, man, it's going to be Sambo Takes on the World, and I'm going to take on all these stereotypes as a 58-year-old. Mm-hmm. Anyway, this went along, and then one night he called me in a panic after about a year and a half of being on the road. King Hedley had opened on Broadway, and he said, Todd, man, I'm in trouble. And I said, what? And he was seriously sounding like he was in trouble. He said, man, I was at this fundraiser at Seattle Rep. I told him about our one-man show, man, and they offered us a slot, man. So, like, I really got to do this, man.
And, we need to write something.
And he said, do you want to direct? And, you know, of course, I grew 6 feet that night. And about another 8 months later.
It's crazy, people. Like, he had to duck coming into the studio.
That's right. It's amazing how tall I am. You'd be surprised. So that's how we found ourselves in the basement. And the shows, as we got closer to the performances, they began to be more and more what I would call the 20-year-old poet story. So if there is sort of a spine of this, it's mostly Pittsburgh, Hill District, 1965. August is a 20-year-old poet who had just left his mother's house. And there's stories that are collected, like the foundation. The full title of this, I think, gives you an idea. The show, because at one point he said, man, this is me, and people know my long plays, and it's only one person, so, man, it's got to have a long title. So the full title is How I Learned What I Learned, and how what I learned has led me to the places I wanted to go, that I have sometimes gone unwillingly, it is the crucible in which many a work of art has been fired.
So that's the full title.
That's the full title.
Yeah, so, I thought Dr. Strangelove was long.
Yes. This beats Dr. Strangelove.
Damn, so, by a lot.
Anyway, so the crucible in which many a work of art has been fired. That's sort of the setting. 20-year-old poet. And these stories that he told me 1,000 times, I now get to share with an audience. And like I say, I never claim to be an August Wilson expert, but I'm expert at hanging out with him the last 6 years of his life. So I bring that to the stage.
How many times was it performed before we came down here?
We did a 2-week run in Seattle, and then we had a series of one-offs. Like, we did it in Aspen for the HBO Comedy Festival. We were invited. We did it in Chicago. Chicago Tribune invited us. And but we were always planning to do it regionally. And then when he became ill, he wanted me to go on and do it with an actor. But it took me another decade until I would, you know, finally sort of climb that mountain.
Wow. That's awesome. And then Eugene.
Eugene Lee.
Shows up. Now, you've played, I think I was reading, you've done about how many? Eight of the Pittsburgh Cycle? So you're very familiar with the writing. What's it like, but actually going to play the man himself this time compared to the roles that he's written?
Well, once you get past the honor, you know what I mean?
Which takes some doing.
It's really nice to sink your teeth into his language and to sink your teeth into the inspiration for those characters that I played in some of those other stories and that I've come to know and enjoy from the other plays. And that's a lot of what some of these stories are in this, is the inspiration for a 20-year-old poet that eventually become the characters in these Pulitzer Prize-winning and compelling plays, the storytelling that he does.
It's awesome. Yeah. How do you actually, you know, become the man himself? I mean, because you actually knew him. So what's that sort of interchange, you know, like to get at the truth of the guy?
Well, I knew him, too.
You knew him, too?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
And we're not, this isn't, Todd says, this is not the Daniel Day-Lewis version.
Right. You don't become him.
I'm not trying to be him. I'm not trying to sound like him. I'm not trying to look like him necessarily. But the effort is to try to conjure his spirit through his storytelling and stuff, and through the honest and clear storytelling that he did. And that's where he is. And that's the August that a lot of people, I think, will recognize. They recognize him through his work and through the language. And this is just a nice little insight into the many sides of this man, beyond just the intellectual, but the comedian. This is what I love about it as much as anything, is the humor that's in this. It's fun.
So if our listeners come out, you know, obviously you're going to think, you know, with August Wilson, a lot of social commentary on racial issues, but you're saying that they're going to come out and have a good time? They're going to, is it side splitting in parts?
Absolutely. And actually, that was the conceit. One of our principals, when we were in the basement, we hung up on the wall, we put subvert expectations. And so the show, without giving it away, begins with, in a way I think you would expect to meet August Wilson. So it's very formal. Mm-hmm. The subject that he talks about is, you know, you sort of, when you sit there, for the most part, this is what your idea of August Wilson is. And then we pull the rug on that. And
that's
think we do
way.
That through
so
the
you
evening.
Set him up a little and then you
absolutely.
Yank it out. I like
absolutely.
It.
And I think it's so strange because I've heard this comment time and time again about him. People are surprised how funny the show is. And I find that stunning because I think the plays are extraordinarily, they're character-driven humor, so it's not, you know, and I love Neil Simon, but it's not that sort of classic joke structure. It's not vaudeville, but it's character humor, and the plays are very funny. And the man himself, I mean, I would, you know, we would spend these epic 16-hour days together, and I would lie in bed at night. My chest would hurt from laughing all day because it was, I mean, we would laugh and laugh. He was very funny, and so I feel like this show brings that. It is a surprise, so that's one of the pleasures, because when I hear that, I was like, oh, well, that's why we need to do the show. People don't realize. So when I listed all those other versions of the show, they all went into the kiln of this. So there is some move over Chris Rock moments, and there is some I'm not Spalding Gray moments, and that, you know, those layers are there underneath it.
Are you allowed to give us a teaser? Because I want people to go see it, but is there a teaser of the more move over Chris Rock moment? How does that manifest itself?
You want to give one up?
I don't want to spoil the jokes, though.
It's hard because the jokes are contextual. So okay. I think that if they sit out in isolation, it's sort of I don't think they have the impact as they do within the context of the show. Do you know what I mean? Well, you can share the first one. Yeah, you can share the first.
My ancestors have been in America since the early 17th century, and for the first 244 years, we never had a problem finding a job.
Exactly, because slavery.
Yes.
Good stuff, man. See, there's plenty of a lot more like that to come. We're not going to spoil any more, but that's a damn good one.
Yeah.
What do we see visually?
Yeah, well, it's minimal. So that's a great question. So we did it originally. It was a furniture. It wasn't a fully realized physical production. But we selected a design team because we had many offers to do it. And that design team is the same, you know, the David Gallo who did the set, Tom Weaver did the lights, Dan Mosesheyer the sound, and then his wife, Constanza, did the costumes. That was our design team 13 years ago. And then, you know, particularly it started, the process started with Gallo and I trying to figure out where is this set. And Gallo is a longtime Wilsonian warrior who's done many of the plays. So he brings that, you know, that knowledge. And we said, okay, we went back to that long title and said, okay, this is the crucible in which many a work of art has been fired. Well, what does that mean? And so we were inspired by a couple of things. There's a great photograph of August, like, caught behind some pages, supposedly of his writing. And so we sort of had all these pages, and initially we had this idea of, like, a wall of written pages. But then we're like, well, wait a minute, these are 20-year-old poet stories that prefigure the cycle. So they're not written yet. So there's all this, there's this constellation, this sculpture of white pages. It's gorgeous. It's this beautiful sculpture. And then there's a almost a platform that evokes a boxing ring, an auction block. It evokes a lot of things. And then buried in the dirt in the hill, particularly in this production, you feel like you're in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. And I love the physical production. I'm a person who is never satisfied or never happy with any element of writing or anything I've done. But the physical production of this, I think, is extraordinary. All the design elements come together, I think, in an exciting way.
Okay, well, we mentioned sort of his, you know, underrated comedic gifts in this. But what else about his writing style leaps out to you after grappling with it so many times?
Well, you know, some actors say you don't act his plays, you sing them. The language in them is an elevated form of what some people call the language of my mother. If you know what I mean, and it's very poetic. It is an elevated language, and that's wonderful. You know, the challenge to doing it is the same challenge that you encounter when you try to do Shakespeare in iambic pentameter. And I think that's what theater has to do. It has to take every day, theater doesn't deal with everyday occasions. Right. Everything in theater is usually a day that's catastrophic or cataclysmic or about a big change.
There's turning points in life, yeah.
But because to make them dramatic and to put them in the theater, they do take some magnification, I guess, is one way to say it. And this language is magnified and condensed to be poetic and to be lyrical in a strange kind of way, and to have the texture of all the different characters, and that texture runs a gamut from angry to joyously happy. That's what's fun about it is the storytelling and the characters and the depth of the characters and the contradictions that are within the characters and the characters that are conflicted, you know, the thing, what they want to do conflicts with what they have to do. And, you know, and those are compelling kinds of characters that make for great drama. And but they're also genuine and they're honest and they're clear. Mm-hmm. I think that's what's important to me. As an artist, I have two objectives in whatever I'm doing, and that's clarity and truth. Yeah. And I think August achieves both of those with everything that he does.
Yeah. Yeah, I get what you're saying about how, you know, in the theater, they come at these pivotal moments of change in people's lives. But this is dealing with ordinary folks. And that's one of the things that, you know, Viola was really saying backstage at the Oscars. She was like, just because my father lived and breathed, it's a story worth telling. It doesn't have to be something big, sensational. And it doesn't have to be didactic either. It can just be, you know, a blue-collar family and let's watch daily life, you know?
Yeah, he definitely finds. I mean, Viola said it more beautifully than I could. I mean, her Oscar
or than
speech.
I just
No. You captured. I think you hit all the main points of. I mean, I thought her Oscar speech was gorgeous, and she's very much a, you know, like Eugene, a practiced student in his work. You know, people may not know that about her, but you know, she was in the original Seven Guitars. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the privilege of working on King Hedley with her. I mean, she's done the plays and she knows that music, and it's like Eugene said, he. You know, what he called his underclass characters, he would call them up until Radio Golf. Radio Golf is the first play. He deals with the middle class. Mm-hmm. And a little bit in Gem of the Ocean. There's one character who sort of represents the middle class coming up. But it's those voices. And it's sort of, you know, it's that pivotal moment. We don't touch on this in the show, but it's that 20-year-old poet who was listening to all of those Dylan Thomas recordings and the poetry and hearing those voices that elevated European language and making the connection later in life that all of a sudden the language he heard growing up had the same value and that there was nothing, he didn't need to reach outside his culture to bring it to life. It could all happen from within. And I feel like that was, I'm putting this on, but that was sort of that epiphany where all of a sudden he let them, as Eugene said, let them sing. And it's, you know, he always said that he wanted to share or demonstrate that the habits and the manners and the attitudes towards life and sex that he got from his mother's house were enough to sustain him in life. He didn't need to adopt or appropriate values from another culture or anything else, that it was all there. And that's the thing, is like his plays, and I think this show, there's nothing in your life that won't be touched by it. There's a first kiss story. There's romance, you know, there's friendships. There's bonds that, you know, survive a lifetime that he touches on. He talks about falling into the clutches of a group of painters and poets that helped define and sanction his life. You know, it's all seminal. It's that back to the Crucible, right? It's those kind of stories, like how he learned when he learned. I mean, it keeps coming back to that spine.
Yeah.
I steered all over, but
no, that's it. No, that's good. That's good. Which of the cycle ones did you perform? You said you did most of them.
I've done. It's easier to say the ones I haven't done.
Yeah. Which of the two?
I haven't done King Hedley.
Okay.
And I haven't done Seven Guitars.
What sort of through line do you see from the ones that you have done that might carry into this one?
Ooh.
August the Auteur.
Well, I mean, when there's so many through lines through all of these, you know, and they move through different characters in each different decade, if you know what I mean. And whatever the evolution of these African Americans' place is in America, I mean, I think that's a through line through all this stuff. I think it has significance because it has that kind of a spine that people can look at and see themselves, especially African Americans can see themselves. But it goes beyond that in terms of the through line. It's America.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it speaks to honestly and genuinely. And it's not the revisionist history. Right. You know, it's an honest, up close and personal look at a piece of America and how that America changed, you know, or didn't change, as it were,
right,
in so many ways.
Which can be almost more powerful to see ways that it didn't change sometimes. Tell me a little bit more about yourself. How did you get into acting?
Oh, wow.
From Texas, right?
Yeah, from Texas. Oh, do you want that story?
We can kind of get the abridged version. Well, I want you to tell me in 10 installments.
Well, I grew up in a period in Texas that I call the BI days, before integration.
Okay.
So, you know, I saw those signs that said white only and colored only. And we were convinced that the white only drinking fountains had Kool-Aid in them. Or that it was, you know, that it was, until we tried
well,
it.
Well, they did, in a different sense, right?
Until we tried it.
Drinking the Kool-Aid.
But that means that when I went to school up through the 10th grade, 9th grade, only all black teachers, all black students. I never sat in a room with a white person until I was in the 10th grade in Texas.
Wow.
And that's when they integrated the schools. And I went to I could have gone to an all-black school, but I was a little smart kid, you know, a little swan, and they were like, no, you're going over there. So I rode a bus over there, and I integrated, you know, the school. We were the first ones in this school. And I was a part of what I call the transition generation. I saw those signs go down.
Right.
I can never forget they were there.
Right.
And I was the one that got pushed out there. You know, you're going to be a credit to your race. And
right.
They got pushed out to the front. So I go to this white school. And I had a similar situation with a teacher who accused me of buying a paper, a term paper that I handed in. And it was on reproduction in science. It was the first C I had ever gotten in school. And it was my mother was up there saying, I took him to the library. And all, but anyway, that happened. And the drama teacher came to me. And I wasn't in a drama class. And she had looked at all the grades for all the students that had come in. And she saw that I had done a play in junior high school. And they were doing a play called You Can't Take It With You.
Of course.
They had a black girl in the drama class to play the maid, but they didn't have a black guy. And they were looking for someone to play the boyfriend. And so she comes over and she gives me the script to read. And I go home and I read it. And I read it. And the character Donald was a lazy, shiftless N-word for all intents and purposes. And this was 1968. This was 1968, and black was becoming beautiful.
Right.
You know? And so I went back to her the next, and she was a legend in Fort Worth drama, you know, high school drama. And I told her, I said, no, ma'am, no, thank you, I don't want to do this. And long story short, this old woman leaned over to me and she said, do you want to see me put one of these white boys up there in blackface?
Oh, my God.
And in a millisecond, I was, it changed my mind. Because that would have been more insulting to me.
Sure, that's a threat, man.
Than anything that I could have done. And that woman convinced me with that statement to join the drama class. And I moved into that class and I encountered kindred spirits when I got in there. Mm-hmm. Because it was all about the play.
Sure, sure.
Once we got in there. And, you know, in the rest of the school, that first year there, I didn't go to the bathroom by myself. After that first time you go in, there's some people in there who don't want you in that school. Right. Then you pick and choose. And so it was, but the drama class changed a bunch about high school for me, because those kids, we rehearsed at night after school. And, you know, one of the white kids would come by my house and pick me up and take me to rehearsal and then take me back home. So I made some friends in that drama class that I probably never would have found had I not done that. Now, I went on to do other things in that school, and I eventually graduated and went on to college. And I have the honor of saying that in college, once I went there as a political science major, I was going to go become an attorney.
Yeah.
And I got there and they said, what's your minor? I said, And I picked drama because I knew I'd done a play, right? And at the end of my freshman year, I ended up flipping them.
And what school is this?
Texas State University.
Okay.
It was Texas State University now. It was Southwest Texas State University.
Yeah.
And I became a double major, political science and theater.
Nice.
And my roommate and I started a theater group we called the Ebony Players, because we were the only two black kids in the theater department, right? And they were doing all white plays, so there was nothing for us to do. So we go to the chairman of the department. I actually played Biondello, the little blonde one in Taming of the Shrew. Those were the kinds of parts
right.
that we were doing. So we go to the chairman and say, wait, we're paying the same money as these white kids. We should get some opportunities to we're acting and directing majors. We should. So long story short, they end up doing a directing class production of A Raisin in the Sun, which Lyndon Johnson heard about. And Lyndon Johnson is a distinguished alum from this university. He graduated from there a few years before I did.
Wow.
And this was after his presidency. And he invited us to his ranch.
Really?
And the very last play that Lyndon Johnson saw was that production of Raisin in the Sun. We were invited to his ranch in the theater department. They took the set. There's a park across the road from his ranch and with a theater. And we did the play in that theater, and Lyndon Johnson was there and his wife. And the very first autograph I ever gave in my life was to Lady Bird Johnson. I played the role of the African. I played Asagai in Raisin in the Sun. And they all came up afterwards and we're talking, and she said, well, no, what country in Africa are you from?
Oh.
I said, oh, no, ma'am, I'm from Fort Worth.
Yeah, it's this faraway country called Fort Worth.
She said, oh, well, you're wonderful. I have to have your autograph. And I signed.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, she probably threw the thing away when she left there, but that's okay.
Hey, you don't need to know that.
No, I don't need to know that, but that was my very first autograph.
And you said that was one of the last plays? That
he died. He had a heart attack. The following week, or not long after that. Literally.
That's crazy. You're performing, you know, Lorraine Hansberry's, like, you know, seminal work for the guy that passed civil rights legislation. That's
right.
Crazy.
Right.
That's
right.
So crazy.
On his ranch.
On his ranch.
That,
in
you
Texas.
Know, that's a command performance. If that's one of the feathers in my cap.
I'd
know?
Say that's a pretty. Oh, I thought I saw a feather in that cap. Oh, okay.
I got a bunch. We can talk.
Oh
about.
Yeah, let's talk. Any other highlights over the years? I mean, we don't have to go through everything. I know. I don't want to get on a tangent, but that, I mean, look what we just got with that. That was
amazing.
An amazing
that
story.
Amazing, yeah.
But the only other pivotal kind of moment, you know, prequel to whatever my career is, I was teaching high school in Fort Worth after I graduated from college, and I was working in radio. I was doing radio. I was working as an extra in the very first five episodes of the TV series Dallas.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which was shot in Dallas. Me and my car were extras in that. We were serving food as a waiter at parties and stuff and in Dallas. And Semi-Tough, I played a football player as an extra. I did a whole bunch of extra work and working
in Dallas.
In Dallas, in Dallas.
Oh, my gosh.
Know? And in 1 week, between a Monday and Friday in the spring of 1978, I had taken a law school admissions test, and I got a letter of acceptance to South Texas Law School. I got a letter of acceptance to NYU's MFA program. I got a letter of acceptance to SMU's MFA program in acting, and I got a part in a movie. Ron Howard, the very first thing Ron Howard ever directed was a movie of the week called Cotton Candy.
Wow.
Which was shot in Dallas.
You were in Ron Howard's first movie.
And he cast me in that movie. And I said, okay, I don't need to go to law school.
Yeah. and Lyndon Johnson and Ron Howard, I'm good.
So I did the movie. I resigned from my teaching position in Fort Worth. I shot the movie. And when we finished shooting the movie, I moved to L.A.
That's crazy.
I made a commitment. I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, yeah. And the rest is history.
And after all of those amazing experiences, you too, sir, what's so special about Roundhouse?
It feels comfortable. It feels at home. It's professional. I feel like it seems like a theater that's on the rise, that's making a name for itself and defining itself in a way and getting the word out about itself. And it's nice to be a part of it on this part of the wave, if you know what I mean,
yeah.
To be riding it. It's great people, you know, professional standards. It feels good.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Do you mind doing maybe an abridged version of how you got into it as well? I would love to hear your story.
Oh, man. How
do you compete with that?
Yeah, I'll sit like, back now.
Yeah, I don't think I can compete. I mean, no, I've had many blessings. Yeah, I've had a lot of remarkable experiences, but, you know, it's hard to top, you know, what this relationship has been defining
with August,
in my life. So in many ways, I've come to look at this piece as how I learned what I learned, you know.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, I met him. I was 25 years old. On the street corner, and I had enjoyed a series of success in my world from, you know, I grew up in rural Pennsylvania where Pittsburgh was 38 miles away, but it could have been 5,000 miles away. So Pittsburgh was my New York. I could never think or dream bigger than being there. So I'm in Pittsburgh, and I wanted to be a writer from the time I read a play that I thought was called The Glass Menagerie. And and I was an angry young poet at the time, stuck in rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And this guy comes out and he starts talking about tricks in his pocket, things up his sleeves, you know, and I'm like, this is amazing. And I could picture
the Tennessee's the one that did it for me.
Yeah, he was
Tennessee
my first one. Hero. You know, I always say August had his four B's and I have my three W's. You know, William Shakespeare, and August Wilson. And
what were his B's?
His B's were Borges, The Blues, Baraka, and Bearden. Those were his four B's, foundations of his career.
And who were your W's?
My Tennessee Williams, William Shakespeare, and August Wilson.
Right.
And I did have, it's funny, somewhere, and this may not even be true, so I don't even, I'm scared to speak it, but in my memory, I had a play done after I read the Glass Menagerie. I then went to see a play because I didn't see a play until I was 17 years old, and then I sort of got hooked on this thing, and I saw my peers do a high school production, and so thinking back, it's kind of strange, but I had access to a car, and I would drive around to all these high schools. So my first slate of seeing, you know, Fiddler on the Roof and Death of a Salesman were these high schools around Western PA, and I went to 2 to 3 shows every weekend, sort of, because I was like, oh my god, I missed out, I gotta catch up.
Right.
And,
yeah,
I've always kind of felt that in my life. It's like, oh, I gotta, you know, I gotta keep catching up. And I had a play done at the Pittsburgh New Works Festival when I was 19 years old. And at the time, I was the youngest playwright by like a decade. And they sort of made a big deal. And I remember actually my first interview, I made one of my classic interview mistakes. And you can cut this probably, but
now,
I remember
I'm leaving it in.
I'm on the phone, and I had just come from rehearsal. I was directing student-written plays for college at Duquesne, and I was very frustrated, and with that play, and then this writer said, and he was aggressive towards me. I found out later he was a playwright, but he was aggressive. He's like, well, why did they pick you? You know, you're only 19 years old. And I said, well, for one thing, I said, I don't write about college kids fucking, which was the play I was directing.
Right.
And of course, unbeknownst to me, that was the Village Voice of Pittsburgh, in Pittsburgh magazine. So of course the quote that, you know, my mom and my grandma, the first thing in print that I ever said was, I don't write about college kids fucking. That was like
I just say it in the newspaper.
I just said it in the newspaper. But in one of the reviews of that play, you know, and again, I trust me, I remember my bad reviews, but this review I remember was like something to the effect of, young Crowther writes like a veteran of life. You know, if this is his first play, if it's any indication of his talent, it won't be his last. He may be our next August Wilson. And, you know, I'm 19 years old, and the last, you know, I remember that I was like, I grew 6 feet then. You should see how tall I am. And
we keep adding 6 feet here, man.
I won't fit in the building. And you can imagine, though, at 19 years old, to even dream that I would ever meet the man,
yeah.
as opposed to, you know, probably, I mean, I say, you know, my three primary relationships are my mother, my grandfather, and August Wilson, you know, both personally and my career, my soul has been marked by that relationship. So that has defined, you know, I've gotten to do a lot of extraordinary and strange adventure. I feel like our unlikely relationship set me on a career of unlikely things, like writing a Tupac musical that went to Broadway, or I'm writing a musical now with Nikki Sixx based on his heroin diaries. You know, I'm writing about, I find these very sort of strange things that I kind of stumble into, but yet makes sense to me in some way.
I want to see the Tupac musical. The movie's coming out soon.
Well, you can see it in Atlanta. There'll be a production this fall in
What's
Atlanta.
What's it called?
It's called Holler If You Hear Me.
Oh, awesome.
And yeah, we're doing it in Atlanta. Kenny Leon's directing. And
we'll have to get you back in and talk about this some other time.
Love to. I would love
That's
to.
That's fantastic. Yeah. All right, but staying on the matter of hand here, remind us just real quick, you may forgive me if you said it earlier, but how much of Wilson's life, the, you know, time frame of his life do we follow? I know you said when he's 20, you know, just trying to start out, but how far do we take it?
Well, most of the stories, first of all, I guess the context is he's 58 when we did the piece.
Okay.
So there is, there's a 58-year-old storyteller primarily telling stories about 20-year-olds. It's not linear. It's not, I always say August was a blues man with a jazz mind, you know, so there you feel the idiom of the blues and the poetry and the writing and the storytelling, but then he would turn these quick corners and then it's like listening to Coltrane. I mean, the way his mind would work. And I try to keep that in the show. So when I was adapting it for an actor to do, you know, one thing when we did it originally, he had an easel and we had like a playlist because August had certain stories you could just hit play. And, you know, he had told some version of them enough times so we could switch around the order every night.
Right.
And but we had it out. He was always like, let's wear it like we mean it. And we'd have it out for an audience. And to do it with an actor, I was going to cut that element out of the show. But what I missed was the way those stories would turn and echo back and refrain on each other. So now if you come to see the show, there is a device where the stories are titled, and it's become almost another character in the piece, another hand, this sort of typing in these titles, and I don't want to give the thing up. But
it flashes on the backdrop or something?
Yeah, you see
the
see a type, like a courier, you know, and you see the different sections and the different stories, and it helps turn, but also helps capture. I want an audience to have that feeling of what it was like when we would go out for a smoke break, and like the director would come out and say, August, you coming up to rehearsal? And he goes, yeah, we're just on break. He's like, no, man, that was two breaks ago. You've been out here 3 hours. You know, right. I want people to have that experience.
So that's the show we're watching. That's right there. Well, I mean, we could go all day. I realize we're going over a half hour here. This is fantastic. More than enough to work with. I guess just in closing, I always sort of try to ask, you know, if they've heard all this and they're really into it, you know, why should they come out?
They should come out. It's for any number of reasons. Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful storytelling. It's wonderful theater. And I don't say that just because I'm the storyteller. But the stories are great. The characters are compelling. And particularly if you know August Wilson's plays, if you're familiar with the characters and the storytelling in that century cycle of plays, then this gives you just an interesting insight into the inspiration for a bunch of those characters. Mm-hmm. And some insight into this man, this young man, who was to become the man to write these compelling stories and these characters. And it's worth the price of admission. You'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll meet some characters, and you'll get some insight into this man's heart and soul.
And you might just grow 6 feet tall.
And you might just
grow. Awesome, guys. That's actually a good place to leave it. But I'm actually curious, though, before we go, while I have you here, since you guys both knew him so well, was there one that, I mean, because there's, you know, he's won certain prizes, Pulitzers, all this, but was there one of his works that he considered his own personal, you know, masterpiece in August Wilson's mind, not necessarily to the rest of the world?
There's two versions of this. So prior to Gem of the Ocean, he always said Joe Turner was his favorite. He always said that. And then after Gem of the Ocean, he said Gem. So I feel like it sits, and maybe I'm biased because those are, I always say of the seven I didn't work on, Joe Turner is the top of the mountain. And of the three I worked on, Gem is, I think, less recognized than Joe Turner, but it's an extraordinary piece of work. I don't think it's quite seen its day yet in terms of I think people are asleep on it. You know, I mean, it was well received, but I think it's.
So that's the hidden gem.
It is.
Yeah. And it amazingly sets the standard for the next nine plays. And
chronologically.
I think that's what's also rich about it, that it establishes character, it establishes the language, it establishes, you know, the other amazing thing about this whole, the whole 10 plays that I didn't say is that in Gem of the Ocean, there's a lot of Africa. It's in the language, it's in the narrative, it's in the characters even. But the farther away we get from Gem of the Ocean, the farther away we seem to move from Africa, even rhythmically, even in terms of the subject matter, until we get to black people and golf.
Right.
And that ultimate oxymoron or there's a contradiction of terms or whatever it is, but that's the progression from becoming a citizen to playing golf in a strange kind of way.
So crazy. And where did he hold this one, do you think? You know, you said that was the one you thought Jim and, you know, some of the Joe Turner, but where did he consider this one?
I don't know, because it was sort of, we were in the middle of it, you know, it was, I mean, it was done, but it was, you know, it never fully material. Right. Plus he performed it, which is something, I think that maybe this is something to share too, is how extraordinary it was for him to publicly perform this piece originally, because he was very shy. In fact, at one point he said he thought about being a priest when he was young. He grew up in the Catholic, and he said, but a priest has to go up in front and talk to people. Right. And he was very shy, and he felt nervous. And then he later said he found himself in a career where he spends a lot of time standing in front of people telling stories. And I'll never forget we first put this together in his basement. And the stage manager from Seattle Rep would call every day, are you guys coming to rehearse tonight? Not yet, Michael. We almost ready. You know, because it was just the three of us. So finally the day came where it's like we had enough of the show to try to put it on its feet. And I said, okay, we're going to come, Michael, tomorrow. So we show up. We have breakfast before rehearsal, having a great time, reading the New York Times, telling jokes. And we step in the rehearsal hall, and all of a sudden August gets like quiet. He goes, ah, man, who's that? I said, man, that's Michael Paul. Remember, he was our stage manager on King Head. Oh, Michael, good to see you, man. And then August said, Tom, man, is Michael going to watch? And I said, yeah, he's our stage manager. And I said, in like 5 days, there's going to be 110 people here. And he was like, the look on his face was like, he was horrified. And like every night going backstage, like it was to watch him, I guess to watch him at 58 years old. And, you know, he always said, he would say to some journalists, I would get angry. Some journalists would ask him some question about writing. And August would say, well, I'm still a struggling playwright. And they would sort of screw up their face and be like, what do you mean? It's like, he's like, no, I'm still struggling to write a better play, to be a better artist. And that's another thing you learn in this play, because you get the root of that. He really tells that aspect of himself well. And I witnessed it. I witnessed, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, pages coming under my door the next day. Todd, man, how was this speech, man? Do we need to do blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and here he is, 2-time Pulitzer Prize winning playwright who was like always struggling. He was always struggling. I mean, that was one of the lessons that, you know, I've carried with me. It's like, it doesn't, you know, if you're fortunate enough to keep doing it, the struggle never ends.
Right.
And you feel that through the piece too, that thing that was driving him.
Yeah.
It's extraordinary.
And even just the guts to go out and be vulnerable and do a one-man show. I mean,
absolutely.
At that point, he could have just stepped back like a lot of the famous, you know, either playwrights or filmmakers, whatever. They don't get out in front of the camera, you know what I mean? So, like, that takes some balls to go do that. You
Big
know?
Time. No, I was very, I was very proud of him. I mean, because I know the fear and I know what what he had to overcome to step in front of that audience.
Yeah.
So, but it is hard to place it. I don't think he had time to sort of put it in the constellation.
And who cares where it places, you know? This is exactly what we're talking about. This is great. Like, let's come out and see. It's called How I Learned What I Learned. Go see August Wilson sort of, I guess, bear all, you know? You know, I mean, obviously he's passed away, but watch it through. This brilliant man. I mean, he's already performed for LBJ, and thanks so much, guys. This was awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Jason.
So much.
Appreciate it.